Okay, so I'm going to talk about minimum uncertainty states, which I think is an interesting problem. I hope to convince you. Actually, I got interested in it myself because I was interested in another problem, sick POVMs. And personally, I'm at least as interested in the methods used to get the result as the result itself, which is standard, it's a boring result. And I think the methods are maybe relevant to other problems too, which is why I put in the title Minimum Uncertainty States, Clifford Group and Galois Extension Fields. Particularly Galois extension fields. Until I got interested in this particular problem, I kind of sort of avoided Galois fields. I mean, I knew that they were used to construct MUDs in prime power dimensions, power greater than one, and I rather thought of them as just a trick to use for that particular problem. And I suppose it's a bit shameful to admit I kind of took the attitude I'll not bother to learn about. But actually, I think having been forced to learn about them, I think they're actually extremely interesting and what might be called an underutilized resource. They're a lot more than just a trick for constructing MUDs. And kind of a subsidiary aim of this talk would be to try and sort of convert you a bit to thinking that Galois fields have got maybe other uses than just constructing MUDs. I should also say that Chris has drawn to my attention the fact there's a typo in the abstract. I apparently said in the abstract that existence of these states had been proved by Wouters and Sussman in every prime power dimension, which, if it were true, would mean I had nothing left to talk about. They actually proved it for a class of prime power dimensions, but not all. And I want to talk about completing the proof. Okay, so what are minimum uncertainty states? Well, of course, we know about minimum uncertainty states in the case of systems having an infinite-dimensional Hilbert space. So you take the standard inequality, and you ask for the states where the lower bound is actually achieved. And I want to talk about a generalization of that idea, or a similar idea anyway, for finite-dimensional Hilbert spaces. Which the starting point would be, and I'm going to use an entropic measure of uncertainty. So the sort of standard Pfaffink-Marson inequality. Assume you've got, and I'm actually not talking about the most general case, assume you've got two mutually unbiased bases, which I'll imagine states are labeled. So I'll call them one and two. And then H1 will be the Shannon entropy for some state relative to the first basis, and H2 the Shannon entropy relative to the second basis, and you can prove that that's bigger than or equal to this. They, of course, proved it more generally, not just when the bases are unbiased, in which case you get a different number on the right-hand side. And I'll put an S in to emphasize the fact that it's the Shannon entropy, because I'm actually going to shift attention rather to the Renyi quadratic entropy. And I'll come to that in a minute. So you obviously the obvious generalization of a minimum uncertainty state to finite dimensions would be one which actually achieves the lower bound. That's kind of curiously boring because it turns out that if you take any of the basis states, they achieve that, which is quite easy to see because if you take, for example, 1, 1, and you take it with any other state, 1, 0. Any other state, you get 0. And if you take it with a state in the other basis, you get 1 over root 2, the modulus of it is. And if you stick that in there, you can see that the Shannon entropy is the sum to log 2 over d. So that's actually kind of very different from the continuous case, because when...
So because I have some idea where you... I don't want to, with your permission, ask us a persnickety question. And a perfectly good answer is I'm going to answer that later. But we started with delta x, delta
p. Yes.
Which are quadratic quantities of the state. They're variances. And then we slipped into talking about entropy.
Absolutely.
And Shannon and Rendian.
Yeah.
So I'm a little worried about that analogy. We were talking about delta x, and now we're talking about h of x.
It's different. I mean, okay. The class of states I want to talk about were actually sort of hit upon by Chris, myself, and Huang Dang, who's a student of Chris's, and Wujers and Sussman. As far as I can make out, we must have independently come across the same idea at more or less the same moment for completely different reasons. Chris and I were in states, and well, I don't know quite what Wujers and Sussman were thinking of. But anyway, I mean, we didn't start off thinking, let's choose the technical analog of Lindemann's for these states in a continuous case. Sure, you could ask what would states be like that minimize variance, product of variances.
So we're...
They're not the same.
So it's
not the same.
We're going to focus on entropic quantities.
Absolutely, yes. And the thing that is striking about this, as I just said, is that if you consider the entropic uncertainty relation, the minimum uncertainty states, well, they include the basis states. And that's a big difference, because if you consider the continuous case, the minimum uncertainty states kind of and either position eigenstates or momentum eigenstates.
Sorry, but those saturate the delta x delta p h bar over 2 as well, right? I mean, if I take any squeezed state in position, and a limit of that is a position eigenstate, the same with momentum.
Yeah, so I mean, that was the actual eigenstates.
Right.
And that's
actually
how
the right way.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, this is not a big issue. I was just pointing out that if you ask for states which saturate that bound, well, they include a not very interesting possibility. Possibly it includes other states as well that are more interesting. And I don't know about that. In any case, that isn't actually what I'm going to talk about. I was just throwing that in to say that the obvious thing, which is to consider states which saturate that band, is maybe not so interesting. So what you might look at instead is, if you're in prime power dimension, you might consider a full set of MUPS, not just two of them, but a complete set of D plus one MUPS. And you might ask, well, you might first of all ask, what would the lower bound be on the right-hand side? And also, you might wonder about what states are like to minimize that. And let me say in advance, I'm not actually going to consider such states. I'm just leading up to the definition I am going to use. Okay, so the first question would be, what would be the lower bound of that? So far as I'm aware, that's actually not known. I'm going to rely for the next few minutes on a paper by Ballister and Vayner, which was in Phys Rev A, either last year or the year before. I can't quite remember. The archive version is something like June 2006. OK. So if you
you can actually derive an inequality from here just by summing. If you take this inequality, which is valid for every pair, so you know that's true for every pair of numbers m1 and m2, such that they're not equal. And if you add them all up, you get this inequality, which so that's a valid inequality. The question arises, is it tight? In other words, can you actually saturate it? And the answer to that question is no. And to see that, it's most, at this stage, I'm going to move over, well, I'm going to introduce another sort of entropy, which the quadratic Renyi entropy, which is defined like this. So you take the sum of the squares of the probabilities, and then you take the negative logarithm of that. And it's quite easy to see that the Shannon entropy is bigger than or equal to the quadratic Renyi entropy for any state you might consider. That's actually just a consequence of the, it's an easy consequence of the concavity of the logarithm function. So if you have this expression, that is bigger than or equal to this. And if you just put XR equal to PR, you can see you've got something that connects the Renyi entropy and the Shannon entropy. So the trick is to look for a lower bound on the Renyi entropy, which you can find it's an easy consequence of the fact that a set of MUBs form a 2 design. So I'm using the same notation I used here, except I'm allowing the index to take any value from 1 to d plus 1. So if you sum this thing, over all values of m and r, it always turns out to be twice the projector onto the symmetric subspace. And if you sandwich this thing between a tensor product of a state with itself, you easily deduce that this is true. Where PMR is, well, I hope it's obvious. That always has to equal 2. And from that, you can deduce that if you take deduce that log of 2 over d plus 1 is the log of 1 over d plus 1 sigma m sigma PMR squared. And that's bigger than or equal to sigma m 1 over d plus 1 log of, from which it readily follows that the sum of the Renyi entropies over all the MUBs has got to be bigger than or equal to d plus 1 log base 2 of d plus 1 over 2. And in view of the fact that the Shannon entropy has to be bigger than the Renyi entropy, defined, you get that. So you've got a bound on the Reni entropies and the Shannon entropies as well. And that bound, it, you can see, is stronger than the one you just get from starting from the mass and the thing inequality. So the question is this tight? Well, what I'm actually going to show is that this one is tight. You can find states for which the sum of the Reni entropies is equal to the right-hand side. I'm pretty sure that means, in fact, I think that in most cases, that's not a less a greater than or equal to sign, it's a greater than sign. So I'm pretty sure that means that, in fact, it's not a tight bound on the sum of the Shannon entropies. I'm not going to consider the Shannon entropies anymore, however, because I think these states are interesting, the ones which saturate that inequality. And those are really the ones I want to talk about. It's not only, well, I think, is it, I said, well, I mean, in as much as I know how to prove that you've got states that saturate this one and don't know how to prove you've got states that saturate that one, I guess that one's easier. But it's also intrinsically interesting, I think. That is, the states themselves are interesting. Yep.
Is there an operational Reni entropies?
Yes. They've got an application to cryptography, which is discussed in the Wouters-Sussman paper. I'm not going to talk about that. But yes, I mean, the Reni entropy is actually more relevant, in fact, to that particular problem than the Shannon entropy. So yes, they do have an operational significance. So what Chris and I and Huang Zhang proved is that every sixth fiducial state is a minimum uncertainty state in the sense of that definition. And I mean, that's kind of, I think sixth fiducial states are interesting. It's interesting to have this property that they are, in a certain sense, a minimum uncertainty in that sense. Of course, it isn't enough to prove that this inequality is tight, because except in a few cases, we don't actually know that sixths exist.
I'm not sure everyone knows what a sixth
is. Oh, sorry. Symmetric informationally complete positive operator value measures, which is probably, or sixth for short, is a family of d squared vectors, which we can label psi r. And they've got the property that if you take the overlap between any pair of distinct states, it always has the same value, 1 over d plus 1. And if you consider these things in density matrix space, they form a simplex, sort of high dimensional analog of the tetrahedron. Yeah, I think they're interesting. I mean, that's how I got interested in this in the first place. I'm not going to talk about that, however. What I want to talk about is that's an example of a minimum uncertainty state. What I want to talk about instead is the completely different approach that Wouters and Sussman took to this problem. As I say, it's an odd coincidence, because I think they must have done it same month.
May I add slightly more restricted stuff in prime dimensions? Sixth fiducial states, if they exist, are minimum uncertainties.
Absolutely.
But now you're going to move beyond prime.
Okay, yes, I should have said that. In prime dimension only, we have shown that a sixth fiducial state is a minimum uncertainty state. It's an open question about prime partitions. I suspect not.
So while we're adding, I believe that the whole discussion there sort of depends on a particular SIC and a particular set of pubs, right? They have to share the file.
Absolutely, yes. I'm sorry. I didn't really want to talk about them at all. I was just trying to say it as quickly as possible.
Yes, as I say, what I really want to talk about is the Wouters-Sussman approach to this, which produces another type of state altogether. What they did originally was to consider specifically the case when the dimension is a power of a prime, a power of two. And they found that there's a Clifford unitary in this case, which has the property that it cycles through all the mums. So if you act, it takes the first mum to the second, to the third, and all the way up to this one, at which point you get back to the original one, possibly with a fade. No, it's all in E plus plus, no fade. So if you have a state which is an eigenvector of that state, that operator, so you have this, then it's easy to see that that means that the probabilities must be the same in every mum. So, since you also know this, it follows that you must have, in fact, this, that H2, Renyi entropy for every mum, is the same. It's always equal to that. And so, obviously, in view of that, they form a minimum uncertainty state. And those states, I think, would form a rather nice finite dimensional analog of a coherent state. Because this operator U, if you think in terms of the Wigner function, this operator U produces a rotation in the discrete phase space. So the Wigner function of a coherent state in the continuous case is a nice symmetrical bump. And what you get in the discrete case, well, it, at least it's rotationally symmetric. It's not actually very symmetric in other ways. It's obviously a discrete rotational symmetry. So the question then is, can you do this for other prime power dimensions? And the answer is yes, but it's not particularly straightforward, and that's really what I want to talk about. I should say that Sussman subsequently actually extended it to a subset of the set of odd prime, not prime power dimensions, equal to 3 mod 4, but not even all of those. But in fact, it extends to every prime power dimension, equal to 1 or 3.
The analogy with coherent states, because yes, they're symmetric.
Yes.
Various, but when it were a state with any harmonic oscillator eigenspace, so all the eigenspaces of harmonic oscillator are symmetric in rotation.
Yes.
Okay. So if you know, have such a state in continuous dimensions, it might be a coherent state, it could also be some.
I would, yeah, sure. I mean, and in any case, it's not actually all that close, the analogy, because it's not a nice smooth bump. In fact, it's quite complicated, but it does have the rotational symmetry. Yes, I don't want to overdo the analogy with coherent states. These things are strangely different. I'll say a bit more about that at the end, if I have the time. Sorry? No, I don't think they are, actually. No. No, I mean, they're not particularly like field states at all. They like it to the extent that they have a rotational symmetry. That's about as far as it goes. Well, I'm just thinking, I'm trying to think back, actually. I don't want to stake my life. So I did plot that as the thicker function, but it was quite a while ago.
Well, I thought the state, I'd say it's all perspective.
Yeah.
This is a unitary point of view. A stabilized state.
Well, yeah, but enhanced states. Stabilized states. And in particular, in constant process, some air function not.
Consider extending this to the case where D is a power of a prime number bigger than 2. So I'm going to use the standard notation. So you've got a standard basis. You've got displacement operators that multiply these things by powers of a root of unity and shift them and so on. this is actually if it's prime dimension. I won't bother with the case prime power dimension. So you have that. And so that's addition mod D. And you get the displacement operator, which you can consider to be this. And what I particularly want to focus on is the symplectic matrices. So for each F like that, you have a corresponding U. I'm considering both the case where alpha delta, the determinant is equal to plus 1 or minus 1. So if it's plus 1, you have a unitary UF, which takes this to DFP. And if it's minus 1, it's an anti-unitary that does that. The anti-unitaries here are important because it turns out you can't find a unitary that cycles through all the MUDs, but there is an anti-unitary that does so in some odd prime power dimensions. okay. And interestingly, I'm not sure this is generally known, but the map that takes you from F to UF in odd prime power dimensions, it does actually define a faithful representation, not merely a projective one. I just thought I'd throw that in. So, yes, I was defining it for prime dimensions because I didn't want to bother to talk about fields of this extension field of that low. But this all goes through for prime power dimensions with the appropriate modification. The appropriate modification means
Yes, you have to define it like this. So I'll call that R, and you take a trace of Rx. So X and R are now elements of the finite field. And XS, XR, would take X to X plus R. I think that's a sum in the finite field. And you don't get every XR just by taking parts of the single operator X. So it's a bit more complicated. Well, I wouldn't bother with that. But it all goes through just the same. And as I say, in the case of odd prime par dimensions, the map which takes you from this 2x2 matrix to the unitary actually defines a faithful representation. So it's not an odd prime par dimension, you get a phase in there. But if you define them the right way, there's no phase in this particular case. Okay. So the problem is, therefore, if you're going to have a unitary or anti-unitary that cycles through all the marks, it's obviously going to have to be either order D plus 1, or its order must be a multiple of D plus 1. The problem is to find unitaries or anti-unitaries which are order D plus 1, which means you need to find matrices of this form, which are order D plus 1, or 2 plus 1, or 3 D plus 1, whatever, a multiple of D plus 1. And the question is, how do you do it? And that's the point at which Galois extension fields come in, even if you're just considering the prime dimensional case, not a prime par dimensional case. Because
order D plus 2?
D plus 1,
is D plus 1 basis.
Oh, yes, D. Wait a minute.
Start at 0 there.
Sorry, oh, yeah, sorry, there shouldn't be a 0 there.
Yeah. Nevertheless.
So if you act with U, you get the second one. If you act twice, you get the third one. okay. Yes, you want to find symplectic matrices of this kind, such that the order is a multiple of D plus 1. And that raises the question of how do you know what the order of one of these things is? Well, the easiest way to find the idea is basically you diagonalize it. If you tap. And if you can diagonalize it, it's then very easy to see what the order is, because you just take the smallest bar of that, the order with the smallest integer n, such that that's equal to that, it's equal to 1. You know the eigenvalues, you can see what the order is. Which raises the question, can you diagonalize it? Well, typically not if you remain inside the base field that you started with. So let's suppose we are actually in prime dimension. So you're dealing with integers mod d, where d is a prime number. And some of the matrices of that kind can be diagonalized, but a lot of them can't be. And in fact, the interesting ones are precisely the ones that can't be diagonalized while staying inside the base field. However, you can diagonalize them by going to an extension field. It's just the usual idea. If you want to diagonalize that real matrix, you get the eigenvalue equation. You want that to be 0, so you want lambda squared plus 1 to be 0. So you want lambda to be plus or minus I. So
to diagonalize it, you have to go out of the real field and into the field of complex numbers. And you can play exactly the same trick with with finite fields as well. Suppose, for example, that you've got Z7. So you can write the numbers as minus 3, minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2, or 3. And when you square them, you get. So you can see that the equation x squared plus 1 doesn't have a solution in Z7. But you can always just introduce a number, which you could call I if you wanted to. Only it's not the usual I, because it's equal to minus 1 mod 7. And then you consider the set of all combinations of that, just as you do in the standard case. I'm kind of assuming that not everyone is familiar with Galois fields. I might be wrong. So if I'm telling you stuff you already know, I'm sorry. Okay. So just a couple of things that are important in dealing with Galois extension fields that I need to use. One is, so you start with Z7 here and you end up with a field with 49 elements in it, 7 times 7. You can, of course, get a field for any power of 7, or more generally, for any power of a prime number. In any field of that kind, you can always find a primitive element. Which in the case of Z7 would be, for example, 3. And 3 has the property that if you square it, you get 2. And if you cube it, you get 6. Fourth power is 4. Fifth power is 5. And the sixth power, you're back to 1. So by taking successive powers of 3, 3 to the 1, 3 to the 2, 3 to the 3, 3 to the 4, 3 to the 5, 3 to the 6, you get all the non-zero elements of the field. And that's true not just for ZD, but for any finite field. There's a primitive element. The other thing is that if you go from FD, so I'm assuming we've got a field FD, which is our base field, and in order to diagonalize these matrices, you want to go up to a field FD squared. You can choose the primitive element of it. Well, if theta is the primitive element of FD squared, then theta to the d plus 1 is a primitive element of the base field. And I'm going to give that the name epsilon. So that's one general point I want to make. A second would be two other important facts. Sorry?
This is true if you're going the root of any, you're just
quadratic. Yes, it's quite general. You can also see from that if you take an arbitrary x belonging to the extension field, then x is in the base field, which you can take to be a subset of that, if and only if x to the power d is x. And the other nice fact is that for arbitrary x, y belonging to this field, x plus y to the d is x to the d plus y to the d. That
Okay, well, I'll just state that without, without proof. I'm running a little bit short of time. Okay. So now consider the problem of diagonalizing one of these things. The eigenvalue equation, it has found the eigenvalues of exactly what you would do with real or complex matrices. You want to solve that equation, which you can see is this equation. It reduces to this, where T is the trace of the matrix we started with, and delta is the determinant. And you can use the standard formula as well. So there are three possibilities. Case one would be that the t squared minus 4 delta is 0, means the eigenvalues are identical. And that case is not interesting. It certainly doesn't contain any cycling unitaries or anti-unitaries. And I won't go into that anymore because I don't have the time. Case two would be if t squared minus 4 delta is an even power of the primitive root, which then implies, of the primitive element, which then implies that it does have a square root, plus or minus epsilon r. And so in that case, you can write your matrix like this. It turns out that you can. And you can see from that that the order is always going to be, because epsilon to the d minus 1 is always 1, the order of this thing will be a factor of d minus 1. So again, that can't possibly produce a cycling unitary or anti-unitary. the remaining case is the interesting one, which is when this thing is equal to an odd power. And then it's kind of obvious that it doesn't have any square root inside the base field. But it does have a square root in the extension field. And I just am running a bit short of time, so I won't bother to prove this. But it's possible to see that, in fact, you must have that the eigenvalues are of this form, eta to the r and eta to the dr, so that alpha beta, where eta is theta to the d minus 1 over 2. D minus 1 will always be an even number, so d minus 1 over 2 is defined. And then you've got that you can write it like this. So any any symplectic matrix of the third type is similar or conjugate to a diagonal matrix like that, at which point you're in a position to see what the order is. Well, I should also add that this has got other, you can also, for each possible value of R, there is a matrix with elements in the base field such that that's true. So you've actually got a complete characterization of all matrices of this kind. And you can even easily write down an explicit element expression, I mean. It is, in fact, this. And it's quite nice because eta, of course, is not in the base field. So neither of these numbers are in the base field, but when you add them together, they are. So you sort of, to find these matrices, you go out of the base field, and then you get combinations of these things in the extension field, and then you come back to the base field. You can also write down an explicit expression for any par. I'll just do it for the case if we have this one, which is, I'll just focus on that. You can, let's cross one, I think. Now, suppose you wanted to take some par of that. Working out the par of this thing is actually really messy. But you can easily do it using this form. It's just this. And then, because you know S, I haven't written an expression for it, but you do. You get an explicit expression for the elements. I mean, it is in fact it is in fact this. Drink memory, but yeah, it's this. So that's quite a nice expression, because each of those things is in the extension field, but that particular combination is always in the base field. So you've got a nice way of calculating arbitrary pars. Okay. So the relevance of this to the problem we started with is that because eta is equal to that, and because theta d squared minus 1 is 1, you can see that eta n is 1 if and only if n is a multiple of 2d plus 1. So this particular matrix is order 2d plus 1, and it does in fact correspond to an anti-unitary. Does it cycle through the MUBs? Well, oh, okay, and if you take this, it's a unitary. Let me start with that one. That corresponds to a unitary, an order d plus 1 unitary. Which does not cycle through all the MUBs, even though it's order d plus 1. And to see that, you can see that if you take the d plus one over 2 par of it, you get that. So if you sandwich it between this, your matrix in the base field, that part will actually be this. And the point about that matrix is the corresponding unitary acting on the standard basis takes you back to the standard basis. So there's no cycling unitary if you've got an odd prime power. But if you take the this one, that gives you an anti-unitary. U, which does have the cycling property. It takes you from the first map and then back to the last. Which means that if you've got an eigenvector of that anti-unitary, it will be a minimum uncertainty state. I should say that one isn't quite home at this point, because anti-unitaries aren't always diagonalizable. In fact, the generic unitary, anti-unitary, is not diagonalizable. Suppose you actually, sorry? It's important it's got eigenvectors.
It's important it's got an eigenvector.
Yes. Not all anti-unitaries.
But they don't have to be.
No, but you can easily write down an anti-unitary has no eigenvectors at all. Follow them all along the problem. And you can see why that is. Because suppose psi is an eigenvector of an anti-unitary U. And if you act with u squared, you're going to get, because it's anti-unitary, that changes to e to the minus I theta, which is e to the minus I theta, e to the I theta, which is just psi. So if psi is an eigenvector of u, it's an eigenvector of u squared with eigenvalue 1. So an anti-unitary, the square of the anti-unitary has no eigenvalues equal to 1, then it's not, it has no eigenvectors itself. The reverse is actually also true. You can prove with a bit of work that if u squared has an eigenvalue equal to 1, then the corresponding anti-unitary has an eigenvector. And that happens to be the case here. You can prove it. Some work. So that gives you a cycling unitary, but only when D is equal to 3 mod 4. And I really have just about run out of time. So I'll just summarize. I'll just say very quickly the situation is if D is equal to 1 mod 4, which is the other case. You can still use, you will still take the same unitary as the 4, anti-unitary as 4, and if you consider the fourth power of it, that cycles through half the maps. So if you label them in the right way, it cycles through all the odd ones and separately through all the even ones. And the other important property it's got is that it's got one-dimensional eigenspace. And D minus 1 over 2, two-dimensional eigenspaces. And if you, for each of those two-dimensional eigenspaces, it's possible to find a vector inside it, which is a minimum uncertainty state. So, right.
kind of completes it. So of course in the case d equals 1 mod 4, you haven't got the full d plus 1 rotational symmetry. It's only plus 1 over 2. It's still highly symmetric.
And then just the minimal, the proof of resistance of the minimal an anti-unitary that cycles you through all modes.
Yes, and you also get some techniques for handling those eclectic matrices, which I think are quite useful.
Does that fact have any use elsewhere? It seems like an interesting thing that you can cycle. In fact, when you started this business, I remember you told me that there was no single unitary that cycled you through all the MUBs in a complete set.
Yes.
And then it's a surprise at least there is anti-unitary.
Yeah.
Well, just a question.
Well, yes, I think you might have been trying to use it for proving existence of 6. And I think it's certainly relevant because the 6 POVNs always seem to lie in an eigenspace of an order 3 flipped unit. And you can use these things to produce a natural basis for that subspace in which the defining equations of the 6 certainly take a more symmetric form. And when I realized that, I got excited, because I thought maybe I can prove existence so far I've had it. But I still think it's certainly the case that the equations are simplified. It's not so much that it cycles through the reducing states. The point is that
not through all that, but and maybe talk about.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the interesting thing actually is I'm much more interested in the properties of the unitaries than the minimum of simple states themselves.
That are interested in quantum mechanics, for instance,
yes.
Or the universal knot. These things are interesting. First of all, you can't physically. They have physical properties, for instance, entanglement. So I understand the role that the anti-unitaries play. It would be interesting.
Yes, I mean. I've actually been thinking a bit about infinite Galois extensions as well. An anti-unitary is one which maps the state. You take the complex conjugate and then you act with the unit. A complex conjugation is a Galois group element. And you might ask what happens if you act with some other element for the appropriate Galois group and then act with the unitary. And that would give you a kind of generalization of an anti-unitary, which I think is relevant to civics again. Perhaps.
Any more questions? Marcus again.